this ball, and the whole idea of having to rotate something around twice to make it to return to the same state. So it turns out that there's a really simple thing that you can do, which is completely analogous to that. Okay, so we're imagining this as our spinning electron. Maybe it's spinning this way or whatever, and we're going to rotate it around through 360 degrees, and we're going to find that there's no way to untangle these strings. And then we're going to rotate it through 720 and find that, in fact, we can untangle these strings. Okay, so that's the game plan here. Okay, so how many believe that this is possible? Okay, otherwise I wouldn't be doing it, right? Okay, so here's the thing. So I'm looking at that string over there, and I'm going to rotate the ball around through 360. Okay, and these strings are going to twist up. Okay, so here we go. So that's halfway around, and that's full way around. That's 360. Okay, so these strings are now are twisted up there, and they're twisted up down there. Okay, and it's pretty easy to probably convince yourself that there's no way I can untwist these strings. But what's really bizarre is if I rotate it now around again through another 360, so there's 180, there's 360, it seems like I've twisted this guy up more. And well, in a way I have, but in a way I haven't. In a way I've untwisted it. Okay, so if I take this, can I ask you to just lower this down a little bit to about there? Okay, now Shehalia's not going to turn this in any way. Okay, and now there's fun going to turn that, so don't turn that in any way. And I'm not going to turn this thing in any way either. All I'm going to do is just grab these strings here, and I'm just going to play around with them a little bit. Okay, so I'm going to turn this, I'm going to pull this string like this, okay, and I'm going to pull, okay, I think I have that right. Okay, and I'm going to take this guy from down here. Uh-oh, am I getting mixed up here? Can you hold this thing like down here, like that? No, that's fine. Okay, so we'll do this, and then I take this guy, and I pull this guy. It's a bit tricky. I pull this guy over like this. Okay, there's been no rotation happen, but now, Feng, if you can lower this guy down again. Okay. And Shekeli, if you can, like, just raise this up. Look. Whoa! Isn't that freaky? Hey, thank you very much, you guys. That was great. Okay, it worked. Thank you. Okay, so I wonder if this table is okay to walk on all the way. Okay. Okay, so let's see here. So I have this, I have a demo here for you. And this demo is a okay, I'll just show you what it is. Okay, so let me just plug this guy in. It's called an electron diffraction device. Okay. Okay, so basically what this thing is I wonder if we can just turn off this screen here so it's really dark in here. But if we do that, how about we do this? Let me go to this thing. And that thing. Okay, so let's do that. And because I want it to be dark in the room here. Okay, so what you see here is this, it's a tube, right? And there's some white on the front. That white is painted on the inside, and it's phosphor. Okay. And in the back here, there's an electron gun. So a source of electrons, making a beam of electrons going from the back of the tube to the front of the tube, hitting this phosphor on the inside. What happens when an electron hits phosphor? It lights up. It glows. It's green. Okay. It glows green. And so this is basically. The principle behind the operation of an old television or a kind of an old computer monitor, the CRTs, you know, the big heavy ones, not the LCD things. The big heavy ones. There's an electron beam at the back, and the electron beam scans over a phosphor screen on the front, and it makes basically a moving dot, and then you modulate how bright that dot is, and you generate a picture, right? So that's your television screen. Okay, so what I claim here is that, so this is like a television screen, except that what's going to appear on there is far more amazing than anything you will ever see on television, or on your computer screen, or on your YouTube screen, or anything like that, okay? What's going to appear on there is truly bizarre, okay? So are we all ready to see what's going to appear on here? Okay, so I must say that I have a power supply here, and so I'm gonna turn this guy on, and so there's a low voltage, there's a low current passing through some little filament, which is making the electrons. But those electrons need to be accelerated. How do we accelerate an electron? How do we make it go faster? How do we change its speed? We put it in an electric field. An electric field, we can make an electric field by putting, say, putting a battery between two plates here and here. 0 volts and 10 volts, there's an electric field. It will cause the electron to accelerate. But instead of just like 10 volts or something, we have like 6,000 volts on here. Okay, so this is 6,000 volts, so don't come here and put your tongue on it or anything. Okay? So, okay, so. Okay, you guys, come on, settle down. No, none of you are going to come up here and do that. Okay, so. Right, so let me crank up the voltage. Well, let me turn this down a wee bit. Okay. Turn down the lights. I'm going to turn all the lights off. Okay. So here we go. Cranking up the voltage here. I think this is on. Okay. There we go. See that little green dot in the middle? Okay. So that's low voltage. We're only at like 500 volts. Okay. Now we're accelerating the electron to greater and greater speeds. More and more energy. We're up to 1,000 volts now. Okay. We're up to 1,500. Okay. And we're up to like 2,000 volts now. What do you see is happening? Okay. It's green. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's green. Okay. Okay, but it's not uniformly green, right? What do you notice about the shape of that greenness? There's a what? There's a node. So there's a point right in the center, right? And what else? There's rings of bright and dark. Okay, so it's basically the center point, and then two rings around it that are brighter than the rest. Okay, the fact that those two rings, those two brighter rings exist, as opposed to just being basically uniform brightness across the screen, is an exact demonstration of the fundamental mystery of quantum mechanics, which is superposition. These are actually matter waves or matter electrons behaving as waves right before your eyes. Okay, so this is the most amazing things you'll see ever on a phosphor screen. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what's going on inside that tube. Okay, so inside the tube, we've got what? So we've got this phosphor screen, so the green screen on the front there, okay? And we've got an electron beam here, a source of electrons. And we've also got between the source of electrons and the screen, we've got some atoms, okay? And I'm drawing the atoms in these little blue balls, okay? So the basic idea of how this thing works, this is sort of a simplification. It's a little bit more complicated than this, but this is sort of a simplification, is the electron gun emits electrons one by one, and these electrons come out sort of in random directions here, and they hit these atoms and bounce off of them or scatter off of them and then go toward the screen. And whenever an electron hits the screen, wherever it hits the screen, it makes a tiny green flash. Okay, so we see green solid on. That just means there's zillions of electrons going through there. Okay, but we're imagining that we're turning down the intensity of the beam, so we just got one electron at a time going through and making a little bright green spot. Okay, so here's one electron is emitted by the electron source. It hits this atom maybe over there and bounces off and hits the screen there, makes a little green flash. The next electron comes out. Maybe instead of hitting that atom, it hits that atom at some angle or whatever, and it bounces off, hits the screen there, and so on. Okay, so there's the third electron coming off, hitting the screen, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so this is actually a fairly complicated thing to analyze. So instead of considering a whole bunch of atoms, the number of atoms here is actually a finite size target, okay, of atoms. And so there's maybe 10 to the 23 atoms. There's lots of atoms. So instead of considering 10 to the 23 atoms here, we will simplify. That's what physicists always do. They simplify, simplify, simplify until they can wrap their mind around it, and then they expand. Okay? So we're going to simplify to just one atom, okay, and try to make sense of what's going to happen. Okay, so let's see. So an electron is emitted by the electron gun, the source, and it hits the atom at some location and bounces off to the screen. Maybe the next electron comes out and hits the atom at a slightly different location, okay, or with a slightly different angle. Okay, and so it'll come flying off at some different angle, hit the screen at a different spot, okay? And maybe the third one comes out and it misses the atom entirely, okay? In fact, of course, you've got a single atom like that, okay, and you've got this beam that's this wide, okay, the chance you're going to hit the atom is pretty small. So most of them go just past, but anyways, we've got some more of them hitting the atom. And then the question basically is, what do we expect to see on the screen here? What kind of illumination do we expect to see? Equal. Okay, so we expect to see basically a uniform illumination. Okay, it's equally likely. So of all of the electrons that, so most of them bypass that atom, like this guy over here. But of those electrons that hit an atom and reflect off, the angle at which they hit is completely random, and we should get random hits. And if we build up those random hits over time, we're just going to see just a uniform green screen. Okay, that's what we expect to see. Okay, so no pattern of hits. Okay, so now let's bring in, instead of just one atom, let's make the situation a little bit more complicated. Let's bring in a second atom. Okay, so there's our second atom, and let's see what we can say about this. Okay, so there's one electron that comes out. Now maybe that electron hits that atom, atom number one, at some angle and bounces off and hits the screen over there. Okay, next electron comes out, and maybe it hits the second atom over there at some angle so that it bounces off that way. Okay. The third electron comes out, maybe it hits the first atom, random angle, bounces a random direction, hits the screen at a random point. So with two atoms here, okay, what do we expect to see? What kind of pattern do we expect to see? What's that? Still equal, right? I mean, so what? So if we've got one atom, we have this random scattering, and they hit the screen all over the place. If we have a second atom there, there's just more places to scatter off of. Okay? And so what we'd expect is just totally random. Okay? So that's what we expect to see. No particular pattern of hits, just a uniform greenness. Okay? But when we actually do an experiment of this type, okay, we find that there's a very specific pattern of hits. Okay? It's not just uniform. It's not just random like that. Okay? And the pattern of hits looks something like this. Okay, so there are spots on the screen where electrons do hit, that's the green blobs here, and there are definitely spots where the electrons do not hit. Okay, that's the pattern that you're seeing here. The bright green circle is a place where electrons hit. The red X is a place in between those two bright bands. Okay, that's dark. Okay, so there's a definite pattern of hits, and we're looking at that and thinking, well, how is that possible? What's going on here? Okay, so that's our question. How is this possible? So let's just go back. If we have, like, why this is so stunning is because if we have one atom there, there's no reason why any given electron can't hit that atom at the right angle so that it hits the screen at that point. Okay, if you're firing zillions of electrons through here, then the chances are one of those electrons is going to hit the atom exactly right so that it will hit that spot on the screen. Okay, there's no reason why an electron starting from here can't end up at that spot on the screen. Absolutely no reason. We all agree? Okay. Now we have a second atom, and we ask the same question. Okay, well, there's no reason why an electron can't go from there to there scattering off of that second electron. No reason whatsoever, right? There's no reason why electrons can't hit that spot. Okay. Now here's the really bizarre thing. Okay, when we put two of them now, two atoms side by side, everything changes dramatically. Okay, first electron over here, there's no reason why it can't do that. Okay, but it doesn't do that. Okay, so somehow with just one atom there, there's no reason why it can't hit that spot on the screen. Suddenly we bring in the second atom, and now suddenly we can't hit that spot on the screen anymore. Even though the electron is taking this path, hitting the first atom. So here's the difference. Let me see if I can reverse this. No, that's going to mess it up. Okay, so here's the idea. With this guy gone, there's no reason why the electron can't get from there to there. Okay? But suddenly with this guy present, it can no longer get there. How is it possible that taking this path here, this guy even knows about this second atom? If it's bouncing off of this one, how does it even feel the presence of that one? How does it even know that one exists? I mean, it's just crazy, right? Same and vice versa for the other one, right? With this guy not present, there's no reason why the electron can't go from there to there. And in fact, it does. Okay? We do see electrons hitting there when this other atom isn't present. We stick the second atom there, and somehow, although the electron is hitting the second atom, it somehow knows about the first one, the presence of the first one. That's like totally bizarre. Okay? So we can make sense of this by recognizing that the pattern of hits on the screen, light, dark, depends upon something very important. It depends upon the difference in path length between the electron hitting one atom and going to a point on the screen and the other. So what I mean is, so here is one point on the screen where an electron can hit, for example. The difference between this length of the electron hitting the first one and this length of the electron hitting the second one, there's a path difference, okay? And so if you consider that point on the screen, there's a certain path difference between those two paths. If you consider a second point on the screen, say, for example, that one, there's a path difference between the two red paths. And if you carefully calculate the path difference as you move along the screen, you'll find that the path difference varies. It changes. But it changes in a regular way. It changes in a way that directly corresponds to these bright, dark fringes. Okay? So what's being said here is that somehow, when an electron goes from here to here, it somehow knows about the path difference. It knows about the difference between that length of path and that length of path. And the only way it can know such a difference is if it is simultaneously in both paths. Okay? So that's what I mean about this thing being rather bizarre. It's showing you direct evidence right in front of your face that the electron is doing two things at once. Okay? So this is what we talked about a lot. In the everyday world, we have possibilities X or Y. In the quantum world, we have possibilities. We can replace or with and. Okay? So the electron can exist in both of these paths simultaneously, or more to the point, the electron can exist at these two points in space simultaneously. Okay? Or behave as if they are in that kind of weird, freaky state. Okay? All right. So either that or there's other interpretations. That's sort of inconsistent with the Copenhagen interpretation. There's also the many worlds interpretation. So I think some of you are with Ward Struve. Done some mentoring. Did you guys talk about different interpretations a little bit? You talked about Bohmian interpretation, right? And that. So there's a variety of different interpretations, and one of them is the many worlds. So in the many worlds, so either we're saying the electron is doing, two things at once in two places at once, or we're saying that the entire universe splits at this point, okay, into two universes, okay, one in which the electron takes this path and the other universe it takes the other path. Okay, and the fact that there is this freaky pattern on this screen here, those light and dark, right here, right inside this tube, is where two universes are overlapping. Okay, it has split. The electron leaves here, two universes are born, or the universe splits into two, and during the time that this weird interference is happening, those two universes are overlapping. Okay, that's what we're saying. Okay, like just crazy things like that are happening. Okay, or other interpretations. There's Bohmian interpretation, all that stuff. Okay, so now here's something that's going to totally blow your mind. Okay, so this is basically double slit. You all recognize this as the double slit experiment, right? In a different form, right? Okay, now I'm going to show you something which is often a question with a double slit. What happens if you look to find out which slit it's actually going through? And the answer is that the interference, what happens to the interference pattern? It disappears, okay? I want to show you a really dramatic example of that. Okay, so instead of considering two atoms here, let's go back to all the atoms. How many atoms are in here? Four. There's 10 to the 23. 10 to the 23 atoms physically. I only got, I'm showing, I can't draw 10 to the 23 atoms on my PowerPoint. Okay, so I got my 4 equals 10 to the 23 atoms on there. And here's the idea. Okay, so with the double slit, what we want to do is somehow observe which slit it's going through. The analog here is, let's try to ask which atom the electron scatters off of. Okay, so let me just reiterate here. So in getting from that point to that point on the screen, say, the idea is the electron simultaneously exists in all possible paths. Okay? And the idea is, well, okay, unless we are actually looking. Okay, if we're actually looking, then we find that, oh, in fact, no, it's not in all possible paths simultaneously. It's really only in one or the other or the other. Okay, so somehow if we were looking, so if when we're not looking, so our eyes are closed, then what we find is all possible paths. If we were to look, then we would find that it just reduces to one. It's really only going on one. How in this case can we look? Give me an example of how do you think we could look at that electron? How do you think we could determine after the fact which path the electron took? So we're releasing one electron at this end, and we're seeing one flash on the screen, and we're trying to determine after the fact which path the electron took. How do you think we could do that? Yeah.
Particles, and you can see where a photon came off, because a photon interacting, you know, gets off another photon.
Yeah, so that's the kind of thing that we're looking for. Okay, so the kind of thing we're looking for is the electron is scattering off of one of these atoms. Maybe it has an effect on that atom, or maybe it emits another particle or something. Okay, so that's the kind of thing we're looking for. Okay, and a particularly convenient physical mechanism to grab a hold of, to make use of here, is the idea of electron spin, which we just talked about. Okay, so here's the idea. What we do is we make, like, let me just show the picture here. So we consider the electron spin. So we're imagining the electron here as it flies through space here in sort of a classical way. We're thinking of it as a spinning top. Or let's say it's a billiard ball. So a billiard ball is coming in like this, the cue ball, and it's hitting one of these guys, which we'll think of as a billiard ball. So if I have a cue ball coming in, the white ball, and I hit it with my stick, so there's spin. Okay, so this thing is spinning, say this way, counterclockwise. When it hits this atom here, it might impart some spin or angular momentum to that atom. So you can see if you go counterclockwise, you know when you're shooting pool, if you spin it counterclockwise, it hits that ball, it'll make that ball rotate clockwise. So some of the angular momentum of this guy is or the rotational motion of this guy is transferred to that guy. So what does that mean? That means, okay, so how do we do this experiment? So what we do is we start out with all of the atoms not spinning. Okay? There's 10 to the 23 of them. Okay? We make sure they're all not spinning. And then we allow one electron to be released here and hit the screen somewhere over there. Okay? And then what we do is we go with a very, very large magnifying glass, and we look at every single one of those 10 to the 23 atoms inside this little sample of stuff there, and we determine which one ended up spinning, which one has a little bit of spin. Okay? And then we say, aha, this one is spinning. So we know out of all possible paths here, you know, bouncing off of any one of these guys, it actually bounced off this thing. Okay? Now, you can imagine that this is a rather like a needle in a haystack type of activity, right? Going in there and trying to find one out of 10 to the 23 atoms, which one ended up spinning. Okay? So in practice, it's impossible to do. But in principle, it is possible to do. And nature doesn't care about things whether they're hard to do or easy. The fact that it is possible to do in principle even means that it changes the interference pattern here dramatically. Okay? It changes the interference pattern from this, light, dark, light, dark, light, dark, these rings, to totally washed out. It totally washes out the interference pattern. Isn't that freaky? The fact that you could even in principle determine a change in the spin of one of those 10 to the 23 atoms means the interference pattern disappears. And you can do this experiment. And it actually works. Isn't that freaky? Whoa. OK. So blah, 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 blah. OK. Sorry?
He's asking Fong.
OK. Yeah.
Why we have a so bright green point? OK.
So the reason is, so the bright green green in the center has to do with the difference between the picture I've presented for you and the reality. So the reality is it looks more like this inside that tube. Hockey stick disaster. Hockey stick disaster number two. Disaster number three. Okay. All right. So inside the tube, we have these electrons coming out like this. And what we've got is actually a bunch of atoms like this. And then this, the green screen is over here. Okay. And it's not just one row of atoms like this. Like you can imagine, this is like multiple slits. It's like a barrier with a bunch of slits like this. Okay. And so it could pass through these slits. But in fact, it's a whole bunch of atoms. Of course, there's 10 to the 23 of them, and it's a crystal. So it's an entire crystal like this. And then there are certain directions in which you get constructive interference and certain directions where you get destructive interference, if you were to say, for example, send waves through. But the idea is particles behave like waves. Okay, so there's a big bright dot in the center because the zeroth order thing that could happen is, like the simplest thing that could happen is just the waves or the electrons just pass straight through. Okay, and so basically that's the width of the electron beam, is that central bright spot. Okay, but then there are certain directions from each of these atoms, so the electron could hit this. So in getting to that point on the screen, the electron could hit that electron, hit that atom and bounce off, or that one and bounce off, and so on. And if you add up all those possible paths, you find there are certain directions in which you get interference. Okay, and those directions then form a ring like that. And then in that direction, it's that frame. The next year. So that's what's actually happening. All right. Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about, how much time do we have? Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about entanglement. So we've heard stuff about entanglement, right? Especially at the IQC, we heard a little bit about entanglement. And what I'd like to do is make this concept of entanglement, which is very, very bizarre, a little bit clearer. Okay, I'm going to try to do that. And the way I want to do that is understand that entanglement is nothing but superposition again. The central mystery of quantum mechanics is superposition. When you have one particle in multiple states, you get stuff like this. When you have these interference patterns, when you have two particles, two or more particles, that can exist in multiple states simultaneously, then you get weird stuff like entanglement. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about that. Okay. So what we got here, so this is quantum entanglement 101. Okay, so this is just a couple of slides here. So what I have is a magic dragon here, who is, I have to crap, it's not a very, very good image of a dragon, but anyways, this is what I can find on the internet, okay? So it's a magic dragon who is flipping a coin here, okay? And there's something interesting about this coin that he's flipping. All right, so we got our magic dragon up there, and this is what he does. He flips a coin like this. He flips it up like this, and he catches the coin, but he doesn't look at it. So he catches it like this. He doesn't know what it is. He catches the coin, and then he this is the coin here, and he cuts the coin this way without looking at it. So he splits it into the two faces, okay, which may be heads, tails, or tails, heads. Okay? So he flips the coin, cuts it in two, and gives one face of the coin. He puts it in a box. Gives it to Alex. And the other one is placed in a sealed box, and Bob. Okay. And Alice goes off to Mars, and Bob stays here on the Earth, or whatever. They separate themselves with a vast distance. Neither of them knows what is inside the box, nor does the dragon. No one knows what's inside these boxes. Okay, and then they separate to this vast distance, and then we allow them to look what's inside their boxes. Okay, so Alice opens up her little package here, her box, looks inside, and sees, oh, I have a heads half of a heads face of this. So if Bob opens his box, what's he going to see? Okay, so obviously he's going to see tails. Okay, so that's one possibility. And the other possibility, of course, is the other one where Alice sees a tail and Bob sees a head. Okay, so there are two possibilities. Okay, there's heads, tails, or tails, heads. Okay? Those are the only two possibilities. Okay? That's in the classical universe of Newton. Okay, what about the real universe? What about the quantum universe? What can I do with that or? I can make that or into an and. Okay, now here's where the freaky stuff happens. This is where entanglement happens. Okay, so if I make that an and, what does that mean? Okay, when it was an or, it's clear that what was in Alice's box was either a head or a tail. Okay, and it was a definite state. If I make this an and, then somehow nature is in a superposition of doing this and this at the same time. So if we look at Alice's box all by itself, what's inside is neither definitely a head's face nor definitely a tail's face. What's inside her box is something totally indefinite, right? There's something that's not in a definite state, okay? And similarly for Bob, okay? So we indicate that with a question mark. It's an indefinite state of existence. Okay, this is according to the Copenhagen interpretation. What's inside the box is not a definite state. Okay, so what? So now if Alice then looks inside the box, okay, then what she does is the very act of looking inside the box, what it does is, looking, okay, means shining a photon in there and looking at it and so on, and that photon interacts with what's inside that box, and in some mysterious way called the measurement problem that's not fully understood, it somehow forces nature to choose between this option or that option. It forces nature to change what is in Alice's box from an indefinite state of reality to something definite, either this or that. Okay? So she looks and forces nature to choose one or the other. Okay, and suppose that nature chooses this option, head, tail. I want you to notice here what happens. Suppose that nature chooses this option. What that means is this changes from an indefinite state to a definite state, head. But simultaneously, what happens in Bob's box is what was in there before was an indefinite state of reality. Okay, it instantaneously becomes a definite state. Okay, which is definitely a tails face. Okay, so I want you to understand that Alice is doing something here. Alice is on Mars, okay, and she's doing something in her box. She opens it up, looks inside, it changes from indefinite to heads, and then instantaneously, zero time to propagate here, the effect to propagate, what is in Bob's box changes from indefinite to definite, just the opposite, okay? So here we go. Changes happen simultaneously. This is action at a distance, okay? Heads, tails. Okay? And now, of course, what's in Bob's box is now definite. Okay? And so now when Bob opens the box and looks inside, he finds a tail. Okay? And or vice versa. Okay? So suppose that, you know, Alice looks inside the box and she forces in doing so, she forces nature to choose one of those two options. Suppose nature chooses option B here. Then what happens is this indefinite state, both of these indefinite states become definite simultaneously. Okay, this becomes a tail and that becomes a head. Okay? So her action over here has an influence on what's happening in Bob's box at a great distance, instantaneously. Okay, and then when Bob looks, he sees, yeah, that's heads. Okay, this is what Einstein referred to as spooky action at a distance. This was one of the things that Einstein had a lot of difficulty believing that this was actually happening, and so there's a long history to this, and you've heard some of this from your keynotes and so on. At the end of the day, the fact is that experiments were done by Alain Aspect and other people in the 1980s and continuing on to the present, more and more sophisticated experiments, which basically tell us that yeah, there is something weird like this going on. Now it depends a little bit upon your interpretation, but the idea that here's what is known to not be true. What is known to not be true is, so one way you might think about this is, yeah, okay, well, this is all silly. The dragon splits the faces of the coin and he puts one half in one box and the other half in the other box, and then sends them off to this great distance, and then Bob and Alice open the boxes, et cetera, right? And you might be thinking, yeah, okay, but what's in the boxes has been definite all along. Okay, all we actually see experimentally is Alice looks here and sees it. If Alice sees a tail, Bob sees a head, and vice versa. Well, that's just the obvious. Isn't it just obvious? That definiteness, tail head or head tail, existed even before the boxes were separated by this great distance, and there's nothing mysterious going on. The fact is, that has been shown to be false, okay, by experiment. We know that it's not, we know that that is not what's happening. There is something else happening, which has precisely this flavor of indefinite states or many worlds interpretation or all that kind of stuff, okay? So, anyways, that's a little bit on entanglement here. Now what I want to do is tell you how it is we use that entanglement. Okay. Actually, and before I do so, let me just mention here. There's a fantastic article on precisely this. Okay, this whole idea of entanglement and the weirdness associated with that. And basically, so this is an article which talks about the reason why we know that something weird is going on here. The experimental, you can sort of, a thought experiment is done here, okay, which leads you to the to this weird, or an understanding of the weirdness. So this is an article by David Merman. It's way back, a long time ago, 85. But I encourage you to take this article. It's very well written, and to read through it. It's quite similar to what Stefan did with you in one of those peer tutorials a few days ago with the particle. You guys, some were detecting up, some were detecting down, all that stuff. Do you remember that? So it's like that, okay? So, but this, and then this is explained in a lot of detail and stuff. So I encourage you, on the heels of what Stefan did and here, to just go through that and get a feeling for that on your own a little bit more. Okay, right. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about, we still have some time here. I want to talk about how, as I said, how you use this entanglement. And one use for the entanglement is something called quantum teleportation. Okay, so this is a little bit of a chat talk here, a little bit about quantum teleportation, and it's a love story. Okay, so who are our characters here? So we've got. You got it. All right. So we got Alice here, and Alice lives by herself. Okay, and she's lonely, and she has a cat here, and now here's the thing. Okay, she's heard that there's cat out there, and there's this guy called Irwin who has been abusing his cat. Okay, so she feels like a humane sense to, you know, go out and retrieve this cat. This is Irwin Schrödinger. Okay, so this is Schrödinger's cat. Okay, now you can imagine that this cat, after being through Irwin Schrödinger's experiments, is probably pretty like psychologically messed up. So she's got a psychologically seriously disturbed cat, feline character with her. Okay. Anyways, so Alice is a first of all, she's a theoretical physicist, top notch theoretical physicist. Where does she work? PI. Okay. So how does she work? She sits on those couches out there and relaxes. Now she works very, very hard, interacting with other researchers, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Oh, and on top of being a theoretical physicist, she is also a what's the other kind of physicist? Experimental physicist. Okay. So here she is doing experiments. Okay. Now I realize that there's a bit of a problem with this picture. A It's not even the right species, okay? And B, that looks a lot more like a chemistry experiment than a physics experiment, right? See, this is the problem with the internet. Like, everyone thinks, when you think science experiment, it's always like that, right? I couldn't find any like physics experiments, cool physics experiments. Anyways, the point is, not only is Alice a brilliant theoretical physicist, she's also a totally masterful experimental physicist. Okay, it's very rare to have someone who has these two gifts all at once. Okay, so anyways, she's fantastic. Okay, so she lives here on the Earth here, and she's alone, right? She's just got her cat, right? She's not all right. So Okay, so but she knows she's met somebody, okay? And this somebody, what's his name? She's met Bob. And Bob lives up on Mars, okay? And now this is now Bob is he's working in like a research, like there's colonies up there and stuff. This is a little bit in the future. And Bob is like working, he's studying the water that has been found. We find water on Mars now, and later on we found like fossil evidence of life and stuff, and he's studying that sort of stuff, okay? And so he's up on Mars there. Of course, Alice hasn't actually met him, right? She's met him electronically. She's met him on interplanetary dating service. Okay? And now the thing about such dating services is, okay, how does Bob present himself? He presents himself as really smart, really cool, like good looking, all this stuff, okay? But how does Alice know that any of this is true, right? So basically, she needs to, I mean, what if it turns out that she gets there and like Bob is just a dork, okay? And like what she's thinking Bob is like this guy, okay? Like, yeah, right? Okay, so she wants to go up there anyways and check it. She's really anxious to get up there because she's very lonely, and instead of waiting like the entire 4 months or whatever, 6 months it's going to take to get in a rocket ship and like, you know, carry her body over there. Like, what an old-fashioned idea, right? Carry her body physically over there. What she wants to do is construct a device to teleport herself over, to quantum teleport herself from here to here in a lot less than 4 months or 6 months, okay? So she wants to get there quickly, and she also has the skills to do this because she's super theoretical physicist, super experimental physicist, okay? So she wants to build this quantum teleportation machine so that she can get to Mars there and hang out with Bob. Okay, so we need to talk a little bit about what quantum teleportation is. So let's see. First of all, what do we mean by the word teleportation? What?
Instant travel.
Instant travel, okay. I would agree with the travel part. I might not agree with the instant part. Why wouldn't I agree with the instant part? Nothing's instant. There's a speed limit in the universe, speed of light. Okay, so one of the first things we would say is, okay, it's travel of some sort, but it can't happen instantaneously. So what we would imagine is something like this. So here's Alice here, and then she's going to end up there somewhere else. She's going to travel. Okay, so by teleportation, we might have in mind not a continuous journey, okay, where she's always sort of there, and we kind of see her or whatever moving, like we see her inside her little car, you know, driving her car or something, right? She somehow disappears here, and then there's some delay, and then she ends up over there, somewhere else, okay? That's sort of what I would think of when I think of the word teleportation. But one of the key things is that there's a time delay involved, okay? There's a speed limit in our universe, less than the speed of light. Okay, so somehow we probably want to get Alice here from the Earth to Mars here. Okay, so one way that we might imagine doing this whole teleportation thing, is to take Alice, disassemble her into individual atoms. Okay, there's a carbon atom, there's an oxygen atom. Like, disassemble all the atoms, and of course, while you're disassembling Alice, you should be paying attention to how those atoms were connected together. Okay, so that you could reconstruct her again, right? Okay, we don't want to just like wreck her, right? Okay, so disassemble into individual atoms, take those atoms and beam those atoms over, beam the physical atoms, 10 million or 10 to the 23 carbon atoms, oxygen atoms, beam all those atoms over, and including the information, the blueprint of how to put them back together again, and reassemble like a giant jigsaw puzzle. Okay, so what we're imagining this teleportation to be is, instead of like picking Alice up and putting her like whole Alice into a spaceship, a tin can, and hauling her over to Mars and dropping her off, what we're imagining is taking Alice, splitting her down to individual atoms, beaming those atoms really fast over to Mars, and then reassembling them. Okay, maybe that's how teleportation works. Okay, well, it turns out that this is unnecessarily complicated. Here's a fact about our quantum universe that's very important, hugely important. Okay, quantum fact number one: all atoms of the same type, like hydrogen atom, are truly identical. are truly indistinguishable. So what does that mean? That means that an oxygen atom, say here on the Earth, is truly identical to an oxygen atom on Mars. Okay, so all you really need to do is measure the information of how those atoms are put together. Just send the information over and reconstruct ALICE using atoms on Mars, because they are truly identical. And there are simple experiments that you can do which show that, like, qualitatively that this is true. It is impossible with any technology ever in the future or whatever to distinguish between one hydrogen atom and another. In other words, if I had two hydrogen atoms like this in the same state, say the ground state, and I were to put them behind my back and shuffle them back and forth like this an arbitrary number of times and pull them back out again, there would be no experiment you could ever construct now or in the entire future history of the universe to distinguish between those. They are truly indistinguishable. So let's use the atoms on Mars to reconstruct ALICE. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay, so we will just we don't need to send the atoms. We just need to send the information, the blueprint of how to construct an ALICE. Okay, using atoms on Mars. Okay, so there's the problem. We're going to get two copies of ALICE. Okay, so here's the ALICE on the Earth, and there's a pile of atoms over there. So what we're going to do is somehow measure the information about how all those atoms are interconnected and tied together and everything, measure that information, beam the information over, and then use that information as a blueprint to reconstruct ALICE out of atoms on Mars. Then we're going to get two identical copies of ALICE. Okay, that's a little bit problematic. Okay, so the picture is we start with the real ALICE over here. We start with a big heap of atoms over there, same number of carbon atoms as an ALICE, same number of oxygen atoms as an ALICE or whatever. Measure the information somehow, beam that information over to Mars, and then we have this fancy reassembling machine which basically puts that blueprint into action. Then we have two ALICEs. What is the problem with having two ALICEs, two identical ALICEs? There's
nothing. Problems.
Yeah, philosophical problems.
Personal identity and all that.
Personal identity problems. Yes, and actually, let's get more to the point. This ALICE over here? She's lonely. She wants to go to Mars, right? To link up with Bob, right? And then what she finds out is her sort of like her twin. It's her twin up there who's having fun with Bob and relaxing, you know, martinis and stuff or whatever, right? And, you know, so there's jealousy, and then this ALICE is actually then going to get in a spaceship, go over here and, like, you know, like, whatever. It would be a bad scene, okay? So we can't have two copies of ALICE, okay? So here's something. Here's quantum fact number two. So the fact is, this can't happen in our universe. It turns out that if we have some object, okay, over here, an ALICE or a piece of chalk or whatever, and we want to construct a quantum identical version of that thing, we can't. Okay, it's impossible to do this. It's called the no cloning theorem. Okay, and this was proven, I don't remember when, 90s or something like that. So it's impossible to create a quantum identical version of an object. Okay, so quantum teleportation, whatever it is, must somehow destroy the original. Okay, so what we have then is just the reverse of what we started with. We started with ALICE over here and a heap of atoms over here. We end up with ALICE over there on Mars and a heap of atoms over here. All the atoms of ALICE are still here, but all of the information that tells us how those atoms are connected has been stripped off, and we just have this heap of useless atoms. Yeah.
Is there a new ALICE?
And this ALICE here is identical to the old ALICE.
That's the original one.
Is there continuity in the identity?
Well, yeah, I don't know. These are all questions, right?
Yeah.
But what would it feel like for this ALICE? She starts over here. And then something happens. Some information is measured or whatever, and her consciousness Who knows? Like, and then at the next moment, the next instant, she finds herself on Mars and she opens up her eyes.
She's thinking, I really want to go over to see Bob.
And then the word Bob is in her head, and
what
then
is real.
Bob.
But the original one is dead.
But this Alice, kickstarts in the same mental state because we put it to.
Okay,
I don't know. So, okay, suppose that they are quantum identical. Like, there's no way you could ever in any. Okay, let's go on here. I'll convince you how quantum identical this person is. This imposter over here. This second person. Okay, so the original Alice must be destroyed. We are teleporting Alice. We are not making a copy of her. It's not a facsimile. Okay. So the big question that we face is, how do we actually measure all the information in Alice? So presumably, it might be possible, right? If I know how many atoms she's got or whatever, and I measure all the information, then all I got to do is send the information over there and reconstruct, right? Using atoms over there. But how do we measure that information? Okay, here's the bald fact. We can't. Okay? All right. So there's quantum fact number, whatever we're up to. Heisenberg uncertainty principle limits the amount of information that we can extract from a physical system. Okay, remember, we can't measure position and momentum simultaneously. That kind of situation is happening. And worse, certain quantum information, basically in information in entangled states and so on, you can't even actually measure. You can't measure that. Okay, measurement basically destroys the destroys that delicate superposition of states, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, you can't even access that information. Okay, so what that means is our whole idea, our whole dream, Alice's whole dream of teleporting to Mars is a fiction. Okay, it can't be done. Okay, so do you think we should stop now?
No.
Let's just get up. Okay, well, it turns out some guy, Charles Bennett, a very bright fellow, and et al., so his colleagues, in, what is that, 14 years ago, 15 years ago, discovered that quantum entanglement, what I just talked about, the dragon and the flipping coin and these weird things, these two boxes and stuff, that quantum entanglement phenomenon can be used to send the information from Earth up to Mars, but you can send the information without actually looking at it, without actually measuring it. So it's sort of like you close your eyes and you do this thing and quantum information just gets sent over there to Mars. But no one knows what it is. Okay? So it's really, really cool. Okay, so let's see. So let's see how this works. So quantum teleportation is possible using entanglement. Okay? So that's the thing. So let's see how this whole thing works. So the first thing is, this is a sort of like a parental guidance warning. Okay, so the following is science fiction. Okay, we can't actually construct such devices yet, at least, and so it's intended for a mature audience only. All right, so here's how it works. Okay, so remember, we've got Alice on the Earth. She wants to get to Mars. So there's Alice, and she is in she's in a meditative state, and she's there's something that's going to happen to her, and she's going to arrive on Mars. Okay, so here she is on the Earth right now. And what we have here, so that's the Alice. And now comes the physics part of it. So Alice is in this little lab. Okay? Where's this lab located?
PI.
Basement of PI. That's why you guys couldn't see the sonnet. Okay, we don't want to, like, there's stuff going on in the basement.
Sure.
Okay. So here's Alice in her little lab, and there's a lab also, big fancy lab, also on Mars. Okay, and let's see, what's inside this lab? Accompanying Alice in this lab and in that other lab there is matter. So there's a bunch of atoms. Okay, so there's a million oxygen atoms here, and a million oxygen atoms here, a million carbon and a million carbon. So there's big heaps of atoms. Okay, and these atoms, every pair of atoms is entangled. In the same way we had those two halves of the coin, which were entangled, and the dragon had flipped them and put them in those boxes. They're in this entangled state, which I'm indicating with this dashed line. So these are the question mark states that I had before. They are in an indefinite state of entanglement with each other. Okay, that's tricky. Okay, that's a hard thing to set up. You'd have to set up entangled pairs of particles, send some to the Earth, send some to Mars, and so on, and build up this stockpile of specially entangled particles, okay, or atoms. Okay, now suppose we've got all that set up. Then what we do is we subject Alice and her matter here to a certain kind of measurement. It's important that we don't actually do a measurement just on Alice. What we do is what's called a joint measurement. Okay, it's technically called a Bell-Stein measurement. We do a joint measurement on Alice and this entangled matter together. Okay, how does this? So I'm picturing this measurement as some kind of a scan, like this. Okay, so some kind of a scan happens, and that scan happens jointly. Okay, and what is the result of this scan? Okay, well, a couple things have happened here all at once. Okay, so one of them is, we've taken Alice and this entangled matter. We've done a scan, which means we've extracted some information. Okay, so information has been gone. You can see information has gone into this little box over here. So this is on a hard drive here on the Earth. Okay, a very large hard drive. Tons of information has come there. Classical information, zeros and ones. Okay, another thing that has happened is all of the information that made up Alice has somehow been mixed up, okay, with the information that made up that entangled matter. So in fact, what has happened is we used to have yellow matter here entangled that way. By making this measurement, we have messed things up. We have taken Alice's atoms and entangled them with that matter over there. So in other words, what we've done is we've transferred the entanglement between the yellow matter here, the atoms here and the atoms here, and we've placed the entanglement between these two heaps of atoms. And in that process, we destroy Alice. Alice ain't there anymore.
Yes.
Okay? She's gone. Okay? So where is Alice now? Let's see.
Hard drive?
That's certainly some of Alice's in there, right? We probably don't want the hard drive to crash. Right? Okay. But something has happened over here. So we used to have this chunk of yellow matter over here. And now I've drawn it as a different thing. I've drawn it as something which kind of looks like Alice, but it's not quite Alice. Okay? It's kind of close to Alice, but not quite. In fact, well, it can be actually fairly different from Alice. So what has happened is, during this measurement process, what has happened is quantum information, in a sense, has gone from here to here. Okay? So remember we had these two question mark states when we were talking about entanglement, and then something was done over here, and then it makes this thing into this sort of definite state. Okay, so basically what's going on here is, what's going on here is this set of atoms on Mars has been transformed into some definite state. But is it Alice? Well, not quite. Okay, in fact, it could be a whole variety of things. It could be like a tree, it could be a cow, it could be like a fish. Could be like a bottle of water. It could, like, anything made out of the same number of atoms. Okay. Okay. So that's kind of bizarre, right? I mean, so Alice doesn't want Bob to see her like this, right? Because Alice has also, like, said to Bob that, yeah, you know, like, I'm, like, really smart. I'm, like, really beautiful. I'm, like, all these things. And then she comes out and she appears to him as this cow. I mean, that's no good, right? Okay, so she's gonna, like, somehow get herself back to who she was, right? And what's crucial in that is this information on this hard drive. Okay, so the fact is, quantum entanglement has allowed us to transfer a huge amount of quantum information, okay, from here to here. But it's not quite enough. We need a little bit more. We need this information. This is classical information. This classical information we need to now send over to Mars. Okay, can we get that information there instantly?
No.
Speed of light. This is where the limitation on the speed comes in. We've got to get this classical information from there to there, and we do so just using radio waves or whatever. Yeah?
Like, what kind of bit rate would you need to get it there in less than
4 months? Okay. So the amount of information here is truly astronomical, and it would probably take oh, I don't know, maybe some fraction of the age of the universe to send information at any gigabit rates that we have now. So it's actually not a practical thing. We're just going on just the principle of the thing. Okay, so we got this information here, and then what we do is we need to transform this sort of nearly Alice kind of thing into the true Alice. And so what we do is we use this information, those zeros and ones, to set the knobs, to set the control dials on a particular machine which will make that transformation happen. Okay? And so we use those zeros and ones, we set up all the dials, we hit the button, and this sort of Alice turns through this machine and out pops a quantum identical version of Alice on Mars. Okay? And this version of Alice who appears on Mars is identical in all physical properties. Like is identical. There's no way that you can distinguish between this Alice and the original Alice. There is no experiment, there's no physical experiment which can distinguish the two. So they are quantum identical. Okay? So there you go. That's how Alice gets to Mars, and then she meets Bob, and she finds out, yeah, Bob really is a cool guy, I like that guy, let's hang out, all that stuff. All is well, and all ends well. Okay, so that's it. Oh, I should actually tell you something. A couple things. Quantum teleportation does not happen instantly. Remember, it cannot exceed the speed of light. The second thing is to notice that we're not actually transporting atoms, okay? We're just transporting information. We're not transporting matter. We're transporting the quantum state of something. We're taking some matter over here in some quantum state, and we're putting the matter over there in an identical quantum state. Now, the thing is that matter in the identical quantum state is identical to the original. Okay, so it is teleportation. Okay. Sorry?
Can you do it?
Sure.
Actually,
you actually can do it. So you can do it. It has been done on a very tiny scale, of course. We haven't teleported human beings. Okay? And it will probably never be possible to teleport human beings. But on a very tiny scale, this is possible. Okay? So the first time it was done was with a single photon across the lab. Okay? And this was done in 1997 by DeMartini's lab in Rome and Zeilinger's lab in Innsbruck. Okay? So this is Zeilinger. Where's Zeilinger? That's Zeilinger over there and his team.
Could you go back to the second rule thing?
Yeah.
Sorry?
You go back to
the previous slide.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, the first instance of it is I got a photon in one state. Maybe it's polarized this way. We talked a little bit about you learned a little bit about polarization at IPC. Maybe it's polarized this way or this way. Same as an electron. Electron can be spin up or spin this, whatever, in some weird state, or some combination of up or down. And I can take the electron over here. And I can transfer the quantum state of this electron onto that one. And the point is that once I've done that, this electron is identical to what was over here. So it is the same as having just teleported it over. That is teleportation. You quantum teleport the information. Okay? And so this was done with a photon first. It has been done with an atom. The quantum state of an atom has been sent over. I believe the quantum state of entangled particles has also been teleported. And what do you imagine about as a practical use for this? I can move quantum information around. What can I use that for?
Information.
Really fast computer. I can use that for quantum computers. A classical computer, what does that consist of? Here's a processing device, here's some memory, and here's some wires along which I transport zeros and ones, classical information. If I build a quantum computer which has several components, I have to get quantum information from A to B. What do I use? I use quantum teleportation. That allows me to transfer quantum information from place to place. So this is, in fact, actually used today. Okay? So this quantum teleportation is used for practical applications, here and now. We will, and as I said, we'll probably never be able to teleport a human being. It'll probably never be practical. But I think that this alone is pretty amazing technology. Okay, so yeah, so that's basically it. Blah 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 blah.
Sorry.
So is yeah, is that a question? Yeah.
Is it possible that this band is in some atoms of this band are entangled with the other atoms in the universe, and when I I do something, it modifies.
So it's unlikely that the atoms in that particular pin are entangled, okay, with those atoms, because entanglement is a very delicate state of affairs.
It doesn't ever happen in itself.
Well, it happens all the time at like small atomic scale. For sure, it's happening all the time. Like all the atoms in my fingertip and all that, there are electrons in there, like at the very very microscopic scale, that are in entangled states. Okay, and but when you go to sort of lab size, like macroscopic scales, to maintain that entanglement is a delicate process.
No. I'm going to say all the time, just one atom.
One atom in the pen.
Yeah.
But the entanglement is typically eroded by something called decoherence. So exposure to the environment tends to erode this entanglement over great distances. So even if one atom in that pen was entangled with something over here, it would quickly become disentangled due to decoherence. Okay, so when we're talking about these boxes that we're transporting to Mars and say on the Earth, those boxes are isolated from the environment. Okay, so you don't allow stray like thermal photons or whatever into those boxes, because a thermal photon is like any photon, it's observing. Okay, and it's interacting. And basically what happens is then the entanglement of that system sort of gets spread out into the environment. Is basically what happens with decoherence. Yeah.
Do you think it's possible for organism, for example, little seed or cell?
Oh, to be able to teleport something that large? Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. So suppose that we've teleported the state of an atom. Here's, say, an oxygen atom in some complicated. Remember those orbitals and that the color of the phase, that color? That's detailed quantum information. Okay, so I've got some oxygen atom in some quantum state. And can I put another oxygen atom in an identical state? Well, so that has been done at that level. So then the next would be two atoms. Can you do two atoms? Can you do four? Can you do 10? Can you do 100? So that's a matter of technology. And surely people will push that technology, right? So as you know, I mean, the double slit was first done with, single subatomic particles, electron, blah, blah, blah. And then it went up to full atoms. Whole atoms can be put through there and also, exhibit this interference effect or this superposition effect. And then you go up to larger molecules. And how many of you know what is the largest molecule that has been shown to exhibit superposition, quantum superposition through a double slit? Buckyballs.
C60.
So it's 60. It's a huge molecule. It's basically the sphere. Like it looks like a soccer ball or a football, and it's we're made out of 60 carbon atoms. Okay, that's a gigantic. That's a big molecule, right? This big lumbering molecule is like coming up to these two slits and doing this weird either mini worlds. Things, the world splits, or it's in both at the same time. And you can observe that. So of course you crank up the size. I don't know how big you can go, but that's a fascinating question. Start with the smallest, form of life, maybe a virus. That's still huge. Okay, to teleport a virus, it's unknown whether human beings will how long, if ever, people would, to get to that level of technology. Right? So that's what you should do. You should get into physics and just try to do this teleporting bigger and bigger, right? That's gonna happen. People are gonna do that.
I hope so.
Yeah. Okay, so yak. All right, so the last thing here, just because I know you probably want to go, we're at quarter after. So I mentioned this article, this beautiful article by Merman, Is the Moon There When Nobody Looks? Reality and Quantum Theory. So on your way out, can you please pick one of these guys up? And hang on, attention please. This is Introduction to Quantum Teleportation. Okay? So the stuff that I said about if I back this guy up a little bit, okay, this process here. This whole process of the machine and all this stuff, how does this machine work here? And how does this work? How do you make this joint measurement? What does this information here mean? How is Alice different from a cow here? And how the machine works to process Alice into the quantum identical Alice? The entire process is explained in great detail in this four pager. Okay, and but instead of dealing with an Alice, it deals with just two particles. Okay, and so it's a very simplified version of all of this stuff going on, and you can understand it in detail very easily. So please pick this up on your way out. And if you haven't picked up the quantum exercise particle in a box and solution, pick one of these up. But if you have, then leave it here for others who have, because haven't. Because is there anyone else?
I have three of these up.
And there are three.